This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for July and August 2014. I'm Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Lindsay Garbutt, assistant editor for the magazine. On the podcast, we listen to some of the poems in the current issue. This month, we'll hear from Rosanna Warren.
No, the story didn't slide that way.
And from Thomas Sayers Ellis.
Crouch! If you a bum, what a mumbo jumbo's reckless, poisonous reads.
And then we'll talk with Dorothea Lasky about poetry and color.
When you write poems, you're always abstracting things into their essences. And that's, I think, what happens when you put colors onto things.
Rosanna Warren is a poet who teaches in the Committee for Social Thought at the University of Chicago. She's been in the magazine before, and we have two new poems in the July-August issue.
The first one we're going to hear is called Graffiti. It describes an industrial neighborhood in Queens that's riddled with this stuff.
Graffiti. Kitty goes commando and the Goldman rats, phooey. That blue scaffolding holds up the sky. Who did we think we were padlocking in or out? Give me that huge, looping, black script no one can read, a secret glyph. And just where someone has smashed the window, Jesus, the way, the truth, the life, and a dented aluminum frame. He bent down, we know, and wrote something illegible on the ground. A toothy black and white dinosaur gapes. I like the crack in this wall of monsters where skylines topple and ogres twiddle train tracks in their claws like pipe cleaners. Down the long, semi-abandoned street in Queens, calligraphy gallops toward the shop displaying, like guitar strings, seven different iron rods for gates. Hole in the wall, rose sound hole, ribbed sounding board. Always from fissures and gaps, melody strains as trains thunder clank across the girdered overpass. A siren keens, and a solitary man ambles past amputated acacias, fisting out with leaves.
I love the way this poem blurs the line between the graffiti and the rest of the city.
Mm-hmm.
So that towards the end there, you know, you have the calligraphy galloping towards the shop that's displaying these different iron rods. And then she has that wonderful image at the end of a solitary man ambles past amputated acacias, fisting out with leaves. You almost don't know if that's a real man or if that's an image on the wall there of graffiti or some sort of street art. It's a really beautiful visual, verbal, sound connection there throughout the whole poem.
Yeah, it's really a tour de force because I think graffiti is something, you know, so many of us just take for granted. We see it all the time, and I'll bet lots of people have poems about graffiti or with some kind of graffiti in them. It's a hard thing to do. This poem, as you're saying, sort of gets into it, the scrawl that it's being described, you know. The way you see graffiti is in these words and letters that are larger than life.
Kitty goes commando and the Goldman rats, phooey.
And I think this poem gets that into it. And at the same time, it also has a sort of depth of reflection.
And just where someone has smashed the window, Jesus, the way, the truth, the life, and a dented aluminum frame. He bent down, we know, and wrote something illegible on the ground.
There's a kind of identification with the people who make such things. Like you say, the solitary man at the end of it. Because graffiti is such a public kind of expression. And then The poem does get you to think that the person making graffiti is a solitary person, kind of working alone. And it makes something legible out of what at first seems to be illegible or a blur. So I think the poem is really kind of the poem on graffiti that you'd want. And it makes something legible out of what at first seems to be illegible or a blur.
Let's listen to another poem by Rosanna Warren. This one is called Away, and it has an epigraph from Marianne Faithful.
The whole trick of this thing is to get out of your own light.
It is the evening of the day.
Well, Marianne Faithfull is the English pop singer who first became famous in 1964 with the Rolling Stones song As Tears Go By. Some of us are old enough to have had a crush on her at that time. But after a well-chronicled affair with Mick Jagger, she became a drug addict. And when she made a comeback in the late 70s, her voice was conspicuously different.
Warren's poem alludes to Marianne Faithfull's rough life, as well as to a poem by Apollinaire. But its subject is an encounter with an Algerian man in Paris. Here's Rosanna Warren reading Away.
She said she sang very close to the mic to change the space. And I changed the space by striding down the Boulevard Raspail at dusk in tight jeans until an Algerian engineer plucked the pen from my back pocket. As if you're inside my head and you're hearing the song from in there. He came from the desert. I came from green suburbs. We understood nothing of one another over glasses of metallic red wine. I was playing girl. He played man. Several plots were afoot, all misfiring. One had to do with my skimpy black shirt and light hair, his broad shoulders and hunger after months on an oil rig. Another was untranslatable. Apollinaire burned his fingers on June's smoldering lyre, but I had lost my pen. The engineer read only construction manuals. His room was dim and narrow, and no, the story didn't slide that way, though there are many ways to throw oneself away. One singer did it by living by a broken wall, until she shredded her voice, but still she offered each song, she said, like an Appalachian artifact, like trash along the riverbank, chafing at the quay, plastic bottles, a torn shirt, fractured dolls, through which the current chortles an intimate tune.
There's a deft and mysterious and even somewhat eerie weaving together of various strands of thought and memory here. You really have to think a lot about it. For instance, when you get that small sentence,
I was playing girl.
I was wondering if that referred to the Beatles song, because the word girl is capitalized, but it's mm-hmm. not in quotation marks. So what does it mean to play girl? So I think this is a very densely constructed poem. And what I like about it is that this is a poem that shows what it's like to continue to think about something even buried in one's own past.
Yeah, she references that pretty explicitly when she says, several plots were afoot, all misfiring. It's mm-hmm. not just one plot to this kind of story. And I think the title references that too. It's a way, not the way. Mm-hmm. Or as she says, there are many ways to throw oneself away. My favorite part of this poem is the end when she says,
one singer did it by living by a broken wall until she shredded her voice, but still she offered each song, she said, like an Appalachian artifact, like trash along the riverbank, chafing at the quay, plastic bottles, a torn shirt, fractured dolls, through which the current chortles an intimate tune.
The consonants in those lines are so rough, and they imitate a sort of shredded voice when you read them. And the idea that her voice is kind of like trash along the riverbank.
Mm-hmm.
And that second to last line is just all these little things bobbing in the water, you know, without punctuation or anything. I think it's really beautiful. Yeah, in a way, she's singing very close to the mic too, I think. In that
yeah,
way.
Yeah.
Thomas Sayers Ellis is a poet, photographer, and co-founder of the Dark Room Collective, a community of African-American writers that started in Boston in 1989.
When Amiri Baraka died earlier this year, Ellis started writing a poem for him called Vernacular Owl. We asked him where he came up with that title.
I had had the image and metaphor of his physical portrait in my head from hearing him read his famous poem, Somebody Blew Up of America, which asks again and again in the refrain, who, and in various ways, and who being associated, obviously, in nature with the owl.
But there was also something about Baraka's eyebrows.
His eyebrows seemed to always take flight. It was so nocturnal and owl-like to me. And of course, the way he made his own alphabet, language, syntax, surrealism, those things, just put vernacular and owl together.
The poem, Thomas told us, is meant to be an extension of the many different styles that Baraka embraced throughout his career.
And it is at the same time an elegy, and it's at the same time a challenging and questioning of the critics of the amount of, I'll call, limitations they're often placed on his work.
When we asked Thomas Sayers-Ellis to read the poem for the podcast, he said he wanted to do it accompanied by the sax player James Brandon Lewis.
And James is playing original compositions with references to things we know about the tradition, the jazz tradition, blues tradition, and just a tradition of what we call literary struggle. So there are a lot of references to the people that Baraka came in contact with. But those references are extremely integrated, not segregated, in the text.
Here's Thomas Sayers-Ellis and James Brandon Lewis performing Vernacular Owl for Amiri Baraka. Get comfortable. It's about 8 minutes long, and it begins with an image of the flood, and a lot of language and sound is about to wash over you.
Old Ark. How funky it was, all those animals, two of every kind, and all that waste, the human shit, somebody had to clean up. Somebody, some love you hugged before fear, the fear of an insemination, the no blues, ruined your bowels. Go devil. Public programs like race. Them's a repub of dumpster molesters. Private like the runs. God evil. Somebody had to clean that shit up. Somebody. Some love who raised you. Wise. Feathered razors for eyebrows. Alto tenor. Was it no branch? Some say a tree. Not for rest either. For change. We are wildlife. Long-eared and short. Pray, 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 pray. Some prayed for the flood and were struck by floating corporate quintets of rocks and Ross, assets, bond, prestige. First organizer ever called a nigger, Noah. But not the last occupier of Ararat. Got thick on Genesis and electric cello, cell phone shaped UFOs fueled by the damp, murdered clay of divinity based racial mountain dirt. Somebody had to clean that shit up. Some native body beside the smooth water like a brook. Gwen say, I had to kick their luck into their teeth in order to save them. Chaser if you straight. Ark old, ark new, ark now. Only Sidney P. would Spencer T. to turn the dinner cheek. Only simple Jess B. with Dizzy G. to accent the peas, not the nuts. Change the record, record changer. Name change the changing same. Something only you could art messenger and dig. And dig and dig and dig in any chord. High water like the woods of secrecy. Always a trail of ways are coming. God, evil, move the D. Go, devil, the mosque watchers know. Also doing the wind and the word. Spoken and written, hidden in love with the intestines of testament. Eyes like a woman's fist, her heart. Facts, not the crying domestic consonants of non-being, soprano, piano, or the cultural cowardice of class in any chord of standardized she music, loco, risks, slit, though flawed too by penetrable flesh, some blue kind, unlike a pretty shield, loaded free. Wasn't just winter or lonely. Those wasn't just Sundays. The living did not return. Crouch! If you a bum or one of mumbo jumbo's reckless, poisonous reeds, a necromancer servant in a jazz groove suit, a zam and unfit second constitution, a zam and FM ambulance full of broke down as round as we bawled, obeying hawkish eagles. Wah! Young brother so big. What they eating, why they blew up like that? Gotta wear big white tees, gotta wear white skin sheets. Like maggots, like lard, the domestic oil of death and clan sweat. Ooh, glue them up, doctor. Ooh, picking them off like dark cotton. Make themselves a fashion of profitable, soft, muscular bells. Somebody gotta clean this shit up. All us animals on one floating stage, we knew with the toilet, the third oldest in the nation, unreserved, wasn't no bank or branch. Yes, we Vatican, despite Alighieri's medium rare rate of interest, it was confirmation. It was black firewood, some love that changed our screaming Atlantic bottoms when all we could be was thin olive sticks with battered horticultural beaks and eastern screech. Flushed. Two, every time that you, Norker or one of Obi-Wan Kenobi's traitorous ex-Jedi Clampett hillbillies, fresh prince dust. The real religion, our individual expressiveness, wasn't dehumanufactured by a Greek harp in a Roman unidiversity. Where we away, our steel flood means flow. Where we tinder, our ammo podium means drum. Blood, blow, podium, drum, blood, drum, podium, blow, drum, podium, blood, blow. Used to be a whole lot of chalk around the ark. Then anger, then angels, their wings made of fried white dust. Fallen from when the Board of Knowledge was public and named after a stranger or rich crook. An anti-immigrant pentameter stretched across the teepee skin chairs of class where we clapped the erasers 50 snows old. Like we were the first Abraham, where we clapped the race erasers and drove away from K. James V and K. Leo PB and shiny Lincoln sprinkling holy sheeple from the sky. There, powdery absolute rule. Just add oil water belongs to humanity. Just add sugar rubber belongs to civilization. Gold days, nights, ounces, a 40. Mules move, a 40. Move, 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 mule. What you may call, how we hear and get no response. Where we fear, how we hear, how we sound. And sometimes time is some. Even our own sound fears us and remembers the first us confronting Columbus with thunderbolts. When was we not good citizens sober? Was we voting and drowning and rotting like? Was we the armed guts of our young nowadays? Tribe be known. The devil, the best historian we got. Anyhow.
We had Amiri Baraka on the podcast not too long before he died. And in a way, I can't think of anything that would serve as a better tribute to him than this poem. One of the things Baraka told us when we interviewed him was that the first thing that gets taken away from people who are at a terrible disadvantage in the world, the first thing that's taken away from them is music and poetry. This really lives up to that belief. It really restores the music and poetry to the very serious things that are around us.
Yeah, it's not an easy poem. You have to work to engage with the poem yourself, I think. And, you know, there's a lot of wordplay in here or changing of words so that with things like Rocks and Roths, meaning like Rockefellers and Rothschilds as famous wealthy families, things like Yes, We Vatican, which sounds like mm-hmm. Yes, We Can, but instead it's become this sort of institutionalized right. thing. It's mixing so many things in there. It feels like it understands things on so many levels and you have to work to understand it too.
Mm-hmm. One of the most arresting things about the poem for me was that as I was reading it and even now listening to it, you sort of say, how's he going to end this poem? Where's he going to go with it? And to me, it's just devastating that the last word of the poem is anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a way a kind of resignation, you know, anyhow. And yet in a way it opens a door to the future. Anyhow, like how are we going to move forward? What are we going to do? Where are we going to go from where we are? And that word anyhow sort of looks forward and backwards at the same time. It's really astonishing. I mean, it was an astonishing thing to see the poem when he sent it to us and then now to hear it performed. It's a remarkable moment. It didn't come a second too soon. I mean, I feel, as I don't about many poems, that we needed this poem.
We've had poems by Dorothea Lasky in the magazine, but this is the first time we've had an essay by her. The title is, What is Color in Poetry? Or Is It the Wild Wind in the Space of the Word?
Dorothea Lasky's brand new book of poems is called Rome. She teaches poetry at Columbia University, and now she joins us from Amherst, Massachusetts. Hi, Dottie.
Hi.
You write in your essay that you've always loved color, and that in your family the big issue was not baseball or politics, but color. That's pretty unusual. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I think because my mom was an artist, she just was really consumed with the idea of color and how you would decorate everyday objects. So that was what discussions were about and really what we spent a lot of time thinking about and talking about.
And yet, you're a poet and not a painter like your mother. When did you first realize that color and poetry was very important to you?
Well, I wish I were a painter. I was always told I didn't have a lot of skill in that area. And I didn't get any stickers like everyone else. But yeah, so at some point I just thought that the way I could translate the world would be in poetry and not visual art.
You know, in the essay you say that color's not simply a decorative element in a poem. And I think for a lot of people, they'd probably assume that that's what colors are in poems. So what is it that you are saying color really does in a poem?
Well, I feel that what poems do that are important is they create a shared imagination with the reader. I think that colors are one way to transfer one imagination space to the next and maybe fuse that space together. So I always have felt that when you put colors in a poem or the poems that use colors in the best way, they think about the deeper space that both the poet and the reader are entering and not just, you know, kind of a flippant, oh, that house is brown, but just thinking, what is the essence of the house and what color is it? And I think that that relates a lot to poetic language because when you write poems, you're always abstracting things into their essences. And that's, I think, what happens when you put colors onto things.
One of the poems that you talk about in the essay, which, by the way, for people who haven't read it yet, it's almost a little mini anthology of poems that have to do with colors. But one of the poems that you talk about is H.D.'s Sea Violet. I was wondering if you have that handy. Can you read it to us?
Oh, sure. I would love to. Let me just oh, yeah, I have it right here. Happen to have it?
Just happen to have it.
I carry it around in a little sheaf.
Right.
Okay, Sea Violet by H.D. The white violet is scented on its stalk. The sea violet, fragile as agate, lies fronting all the wind among the torn shells on the sandbank. The greater blue violets flutter on the hill, but who would change for these? Who would change for these one root of the white sort? Violet, your grasp is frail on the edge of the sandhill, but you catch the light, frost, a star edges with its fire.
That is such a strange poem. I think that flower, the violet, its name is a color. So that when you say the white violet, like right away, your imagination is sort of having to work a little harder. Even in the poem's first few lines, the white violet is scented on its stalk, the sea violet, fragile as agate. So the colors are very complicated here. I mean, what does that do when you try to work on your own poems? I mean, when you see somebody do that and it's so sort of strange and complicated, how do you recover from such a thing?
I guess I'm really glad, Don, that you picked out H.D.'s violet poem, because I think violet is such a strange color and kind of entity, and it's so important to the color spectrum because it's the last thing, and it's kind of, you know, we think of it as like a divine color, but It's really a strange summation of all the colors together. So I have always just gotten the greatest inspiration from H.D. She's able to kind of always make the poem a mystic space, and she's able to fuse things together without hitting us over the head that she's doing that. You know how white violet is able to sit together, and of course you're thinking of those two colors, but you have to think of it as like an object, as the flower. She's not just like juxtaposing them, she's actually connecting them together. She's putting them in a space where she's using kind of the language glue instead of just sitting it side by side on a shelf. And I don't exactly know how she does it, but I'm glad that she did, because it's, you know, a great thing to try to follow, even though it's impossible.
I love in this essay the diversity of poems and poets that you pull together and how they all use color differently, from Paul Celan to Sylvia Plath and a couple of Stevens poems. But I was wondering, can you think of any poems that get color wrong, or poems that are colorless? Is that possible?
Oh, that's a really hard question. None in the current issue, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, page 255. Oh, I don't know a specific poem. I mean, maybe if we were kind of sharing poems, there's that one section in the essay where I just say, you know, like when you're writing a poem, to try to resist the color that you might sort of assume the thing to be, like the typical color, you know, that the brick is red or something like that, or the tree is green. And what can you do to sort of see it in a new way is like a way to potentially get the color right. But I think sometimes we think we don't want to have a poem full of adjectives, and so we resist describing things. We kind of just have things exist and hope that the reader will be okay with that, be able to enter the space we're in with just the word without any description around it. And I think that you don't have as much faith in the reader when you do that. And color, of course, when you get it right, is a way to have faith in the reader.
So many contemporary poems, in English anyway, are gloomy and dark and gray. Do you think you arrived at this just from your experience all your life of color? Because I think for the rest of us leading sort of dark and dismal daily lives, you know, can we turn to poetry for color? I mean, obviously we can turn to, you know, the movies and painting. You know, we expect color in those places. But I think it's surprising to say that we should rely on poems for color. But that sounds like something you truly, really believe in and are inspired by.
I think that poems are the place where we can have heightened visual worlds, and that there are spaces where we can create colors in the same way that H.D. is able to have the white violet. And it's the kind of thing where we can't fully ever grasp what that really looks like. And if we were, you know, to go to the beach and look at an actual white violet, we would have an experience and we'd be able to paint it or take a picture of it, but we'd never fully be able to capture the experience or the possibilities of it or all the ways that that color could exist if we were to describe it. And I think that that's what poems can do. They can make, you know, a reality which is a heightened kind of central reality beyond this one. And so, yeah, so I vote for poems as being the place where that can happen.
Great. Well, thanks for redeeming poetry for us as a field for this, you know, life-affirming on our end of things. We sort of think we know how to read poems all the time, and your essay really will help readers, as it did us, learn to find different kind of hues and tones in the poems we discover.
Yeah, I see color everywhere now, yeah. Now that I've read your essay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dottie.
You can read Dorothy Alasky's essay and everything else you heard on this podcast in the July-August issue of Poetry Magazine.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast was recorded this month by Alex Inglisian and produced by Curtis Fox.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Lindsay Garbett.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.